is BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, a spacecraft's £1.2 billion mission has ended by smashing into a comet. Rosetta's changed our understanding of the solar system, as Tim Jones reports.
Farewell, Rosetta. You've done the job.
Cheers and hugs at the European Space Agency as Rosetta collided with the comet. Scientist Matt Taylor says they discovered key proteins during the mission.
These comets could have brought the ingredients for life to the surface of the Earth.
Rosetta started life in Stevenage in 1998. For those engineers, it's been extraordinary to watch.
Also a little bit sad, I think, because it's the end of a nearly 20-year programme.
Rosetta's final resting place is on a comet drifting through space.
There's concern uncertainty over the EU exit could hit investment at two of the UK's biggest car makers. Nissan and Jaguar Land Rover want guarantees from the government amid fears of higher export tariffs. The search of a site for British toddler Ben Needham, who went missing on the Greek island of Kos 25 years ago, has resumed. Detectives had to halt work after ancient tombs were unearthed, but the issue's been resolved. It's getting harder for people in their early 30s to build up wealth as house prices continue to rise. A report's found less generous pensions also mean those in their 40s were twice as well off a decade ago. 14 years after two Van Gogh paintings were stolen in Amsterdam, police in Italy have found them both. They were discovered during a raid in Naples as part of an operation targeting the mafia. Art experts say the paintings are in relatively good condition. Axel Roigerts from the Van Gogh Museum, where they were taken from.
Two people broke into our museum via the roof and through the windows. It happened in very, very quickly back then, 14 years ago.
That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
If you think Bristol City Council are doing a good job and that the government are working for us rather than big business, if you think the war on terror is a good idea, don't listen to BCFM's politics show, 5 till 7 every Friday here on BCFM 93.2.
Stick with us to give you the real sound of Bristol, BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Cabinet Member for Finance, Governance and Performance. That's Labour Councillor for Hillfields, Craig Cheney. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, whatever happened to Lowell Goddard? A third chair of the VI paedophile inquiry went back home to New Zealand last month, no doubt after having signed a confidentiality agreement. So survivors of sexual abuse are left wondering why she left. Leaks suggest it was because she wasn't happy with her staff. Well, the inquiry's number one lawyer, Ben Emerson, has been suspended and now resigned too, and the new chair, Alexis Jay, isn't saying anything. So why was the head of the inquiry forced to employ Home Office staff who were themselves under suspicion over the child sex abuse cover-up? Is this all part of a government civil service attempt to derail the inquiry, which could expose leading figures in government, civil service, children's charities like the NSPCC, the church, the BBC and even royalty to prosecution? Also, today's funeral of Shimon Peres, we remember this show's fleeting encounter with the Israeli president wanting access all areas in the run-up to the 2012 London Olympics, and access after the ousting of G4S he was denied. Also, a commander of the al-Nusra Front, now known as the Sham Liberation Front, admits to being supported by the Pentagon. So why haven't we been told that on the news? And finally, breaking the taboo of religion and politics, many rich and powerful people, we ask, why? Who do they worship? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and showers. This weekend, highs of 16, some heavy showers and sunny spells tomorrow, but mainly sunny. on Sunday. Next week, highs of 18 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells, mainly dry next weekend. That's the 8th and 9th of October, highs of 18 with more sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Cabinet Member for Finance, Governance and Performance. That's Labour Councillor for Hillfields, Craig Cheney. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
First of all, it's a big portfolio, isn't it? First of all, let's go one by one. Finance, what does that entail?
So, I mean, I think overall the role maps to the Business Change Directorate, which is probably more aptly titled as resources. So it's HR, legal services, finance.
So do you sort of, I shouldn't say sit on top, but you've got a whole sort of bunch of people in a directorate at the council that are doing the same kind of job as you're supposed to be looking at?
Yeah, so my role is to obviously set the strategy for that directorate, but also work with Marvin to set the strategy for the council itself.
Okay, so with finance, this is a big portfolio here. What experience have you got in working with money, because this is a difficult one? I mean, I've found over the years accountants are very good at pulling the wool over the eyes of people with whole. I mean, this is particularly with the city accounts, runs to about 80 pages, but accountants will tell you there's only actually about 2 pages that really you want to look at.
So I have a background working in actuarial services and then forward into IT.
Into what did you say?
IT, sorry.
Yeah.
I have a background in maths generally, so I think I can read a balance sheet as need be. You're right, accountants are very clever people and they do have a lot of skills. I have a lot of support from the LGA and other groups to help us through that. So,
okay, well, governance is another one, isn't it? Because this is making sure that all the right checks and balances are in place, that people aren't either corrupt or maybe even incompetent in these positions, because there's actually quite a lot of public money riding on whether they're doing their jobs right or not.
Yeah, you're right. And I think governance at Bristol City Council has maybe not been as thorough as it can be. I mean, we're finding things like this week, next week coming to council, we have this issue with the payments we've been making to NCP on behalf of, or in relation to the Long Ashton Parkham ride.
So how has that managed to happen, do you think, over the years? I mean, I know you're actually a relatively new councillor, aren't you? You only elected in May, I think.
And the May before, yeah.
Yeah, so how has this kind of
So there was an
happened?
Original agreement that started in 1997 and would see through for 5 years. And then I think there was an informal arrangement that's just sort of lingered, really, and hasn't ever really... No one went back on and looked through the details. It was on a check through Cumberland's House that we realised that there may be more to it than met the eye, so... Obviously, it will come to us for a cabinet discussion next week, and I think the recommendation is that we pull that payment immediately.
It sounds like a good idea. NCP seem to be a very, very wealthy company, don't they? They do very well. It's one of those companies over the years that no one really thinks about it, but the car parks make a hell of a lot of money. I mean, originally, of course, that there would have been staff quite often in these car parks, but after automation, where all you're doing is you're putting your money in, you're getting a ticket, you don't even speak to anybody at the car park, but they're able to make an absolute fortune. So I imagine they're probably quite deft at pulling the wool over the eyes of people at the City Council. But anyway, look, you were elected as a Labour councillor, so why Labour and why not one of the other parties? What brought you to the party?
I suppose I'm a working class boy. I grew up in a council house in the 70s and 80s. We struggled a lot. We were on benefits for most of that time. 15 of us in a three-bedroom house at one point.
Mum and dad and 13 brothers and sisters?
Yes, I'm the oldest of 13, yeah.
Wow!
But we had... we had cousins in and out, and my uncle, and we had my granddad living on the sofa for a while. So, it's just
what part of town was that in? Was
so
that here in Bristol?
Hannam, so, well, on the border of Kingswood and Hannam, yeah, not far from Hillfields, where I am now. Yeah.
Okay, so but why?
So the Labour Party was a party that changed the lives of people on my estate as I got older, and for its numerous flaws, New Labour did do a lot of good things for people like me in those areas. You know, we were living on something like 35 quid a week, I think, between points 13 or something of us at the same time in the house. So Labour was the party for me, really. I've always been involved. So after school, I got quite involved in the protest movement and Stop the War and all these things. As I got older, I got a bit disillusioned with it all and took a back seat.
Well, really. the thing is, he left
lots of things, and then.
But I mean, for just you talking about stop the war there, you didn't stop the war, did you?
No, we didn't. Well, it was partly why I became disillusioned. But I mean, also there were some unsavoury elements around that I pulled out of. So I left all of that, and then as I got older, I suppose I got interested in trying to help people in the area I lived. I was involved in a local community centre in Hillfields, trying to take that through the CAP process to get that off the council, witnessing the wheels and the complications that people just trying to do good things for their area have to go through. So I thought when the seat came up, I was a member, the seat came up in Hillfields where I live, stood for it and won.
How does Marvin run things? Give us an idea of a typical cabinet meeting.
He's quite keen, and I think this is probably the big break with how George ran things. He's quite keen on sharing the power. He's not interested in being the only man to make every decision. I mean, there's no time anyway. I cannot fathom how it used to operate previously. I can only assume that it didn't fully function, because I just can't imagine how one man can make all those decisions. It's just not possible. So Marvin's very keen that the cabinet members have a say. He's keen to give councillors more power and to be real leaders in their community.
And the meetings, I mean, because the thing is, you've got all different parties on this cabinet. How do you manage to see eye to eye? And what happens when you're not going to, are you?
So one of the key requirements of serving in the cabinet was that you sign up to a manifesto. So the priorities of that manifesto, I mean, it's taken a long time. There are 330 commitments, I think, in that manifesto, which was written by Labour members across the city. You know, it's taken a long time to get those into a priority and a workable order, and actually how much they're going to cost, how long they'll take to implement, all those things. Anyway, each cabinet member was obliged to sign up to that. So there's not disagreements. We have different ways of doing things, you know. But I don't think, as yet, there haven't been any epic battles.
Not so far, anyway. Mm. Fingers crossed, eh? Well, look, £350 million or so the council spends every year, doesn't it, Craig? Something like that, am I right?
That's the revenue budget, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a big responsibility being in charge of finance. And also, a lot of people out there are wondering, well, as the various different services that are provided by local authorities are going down, I mean, I've seen less and less, for example, basic stuff like collecting of rubbish. People are asking, well, why am I paying my council tax?
Yeah, I mean, as a challenge, isn't it? And I think so at the moment we're conducting a review of what those things that are statutory that we have to provide, those things that we do because we think they're the right thing to do, and those things that we just do because we've done them for so long. And there's just a piece of work to be done to decide which ones we can and can't continue to do as the envelope shrinks. You know, local government seems to be the whipping boy, really, of central government cuts at the moment. I'm sure if you work in NHS you feel the same way, and in various other public sectors.
But it's not up for you to just hold up your hands and say, well, sorry, nothing we can do, this is all being done by Westminster. Otherwise, what's the point of electing
no,
you?
No, of course, but that said, we have to operate within the envelope, but we get to make decisions within that envelope, so that those are the bits that are up to us. But and we can, of course, make representation to central government for more money. We will be going for more money for transport, we will be going for more money for housing. I think one of the problems, as a Labour administration, it's difficult to go to a Conservative government and say, can we have some more money, please, in a sort of vague and general way. However, if we go and say, we're keen on building these additional houses or this bit of infrastructure, give us the money to fund it, and if that can save us money in other revenue spends, then that is a benefit to all of us.
I mean, there's £200 million of public money being spent on this Metro bus project, which a lot of people are raising giant, great question marks over. I mean, I've invited Mark Bradshaw onto this programme quite a few times recently. He says he'd love to come on and he loves to be on our programme, but he hasn't been able to find his diary for the last couple of weeks in order to find a time. But what do you make of this? Because a lot of people are pointing the finger, and I suppose it'd be easy to point the finger back at George Ferguson and say, well, this was something that was done under your time. Is there going to be an operator for this bus delays?
On that, so I think the three main routes, so the North Fringe, the South Bristol Link, and whichever the one is, the one that comes into town. I think that, so their operator is interested. In fact, we've got two, I believe. So it's just in a bidding process at the moment. I don't think we have concerns about operators. I think that's just, that was a bit of a storm.
In a teacup, maybe. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, so personally, living in Hillfield, the bus doesn't help me at all. I work out near Parkway Station, so I'm suffering through the Stoke Lane build at the moment. It's a nightmare. You know, it's not so bad because I cycle most days, so I can cycle up there and not avoid traffic. But on the days I do drive, it's chaos. Buses are a nightmare.
Is this a secret plan to get people on their bikes and out of their cars?
I don't think it is. I mean, I think there's an admirable concept behind it. You know, I think we'd all love a public transport system that got people out of their cars and connected the south of Bristol with the jobs in the north and all those things. I think that one of the problems is it hasn't really been sold very well. I don't think people really know what it's supposed to do, where it's supposed to go, or even what it really is. I think there was a lack of possibly a lack of ambition, maybe. I mean, obviously Bristol has been looking at a tram for a long time, and I think probably this was the, well, we won't do a tram, but we'll do the next best thing.
Now, yes, part of your portfolio is governance. Now, this is something that is a bit of a bugbear with me, because I can remember back in 2002, I went down into the council house going through members' interests, and back in those days, if you were a member of a secret society, you had to declare it. You had to say, yes, I am, or I'm not. And, of course, you could potentially even be removed or certainly punished as a councillor, maybe even suspended or whatever, if you didn't put down what your interests were. And then I think it was called the Standards Board of England was abolished, that was making sure that these various things were... I mean, this is what is overall called in all business is called probity. We're supposed to declare if we've got an interest outside. And at that time I noticed that the only city councillor that had said that they were in a secret society was Jack Lopresti, who said he was a Freemason, and which was quite interesting. But then they got rid of the requirement to do that. Now I just wonder what you think about this whole idea of whether it's important that people are declaring the fact, not just their business interests, but also their associations with groups like the Freemasons.
Well, I think they should be declared. I think it as you just said, I mean, it's just a case of public interest, really, isn't it? For me personally, you know, I've declared all the memberships of societies and clubs that I'm members of, not that I'm a member of anything exciting. I'd be nervous to find out if people were behaving in a way that wasn't honest.
Jack said on that forum, when I read it back in whenever it was, 2002, was, but it's not a secret society, which I thought was quite an interesting comment to make in itself. And also, there are questions about the links to the merchant venturers, because the merchant venturers have got this whole system of the master, the senior warden, and the junior warden. Well, that's just exactly what you get in a Masonic lodge, with the master of the lodge, the senior warden, and the junior warden. Just to explain for people, this is because the senior warden will be the master next year, the junior warden will be the senior warden next year. So this is the sort of progression. Every year you have a new person in charge. And it does look to me as if the merchant venturers are a kind of, you know, certainly linked to this Masonic construction. And we know that they're very influential in the city. Have you come across any of the merchants and their influence in the city? What do you make of that?
Am I just a conspiracy theorist? So... since getting elected, I'm becoming a cabinet member. You get lots of people come to meet you and talk to you. No one so far has disclosed to me that they're from the merchant venturers. I've not been offered any secret handshakes or you know, paddling events or anything. So yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how deep those things really run.
Well, I suggest if you're doing governance, you might come across it, Craig.
I'm sure I will,
Anyway, just a little bit more about performance. How do you measure performance? This is really, I mean, you know, we want to know, are our civil servants, are our council officers up to the job? Because, of course, a lot of those would have been put in place by George.
Yeah, so we're conducting a full review, actually. So performance indicators across the council, and even that go through to scrutiny, don't necessarily scrutinise the things that are in... Or measure the things that are of interest to the public, or certainly that make sure the council is performing in the way it should. You know, hits on the website is all well and interesting, but how good is the service that website delivers?
But you could be hitting on the website again and again and still not finding what you want.
Precisely that. So we need to rethink all of those things. It's an epic task, as you can imagine. There's 6,000 employees, and technically all of them are performing some task that needs to be measured in some way. So it is a huge job. but there are key indicators that we need to rethink.
What about your? I mean, you're talking about websites there. You say you're working in IT. What do you actually do for a living in IT? What sort of area of IT is it?
So, I work in financial systems. So, looking at how they fit together, how they work, taking them apart, trying to understand. So mostly I work with very old systems, so it's just trying to figure out who coded what and why and what the intention of that was.
And so how might we improve it
so often is regulatory change. So a new law will come in, George Osborne was very hot on financial regulation. There were a lot of them came out in a very short space of time. There's a lot of system changes that came off the back of that, and so I've been focused a lot on those.
So would we come across the sort of work you do if we were bashing our numbers into a computer, our passwords, and maybe even cursing the computer?
Probably not, because they're so old and they don't link to the web in any way, but you probably would if you've dealt with any insurance or pension provider and you've had annoyance over not being able to get a value on the phone or any of those kind of things.
Is it safe to do online banking?
Personally, I think it is. I think the I think encryption is really, really sophisticated these days. There are inevitably risks. But I think it's pretty
with my bank, I just said to them when they first tried to pressurise me into, oh, you must do your banking, I just said, no, I don't want to do it. And if anybody does try and go into my account online, it's been hacked, it's not me. And so they quite nicely said, oh, we'll put a note to that effect on your account.
So I was one of the, I joined First Direct when it first came along, so I was the exact opposite of that. I signed up for it from the beginning, and I've been getting text messages with my balance every day for 9 years or something. And
so am I a bit of a Luddite then?
Oh, I don't know about that. I think there's a sensible reticence.
Anyway, Craig, we had a discussion a bit about the city's accounts a few weeks ago on this show, and on that show page, which is thisweek.org.uk, a chap called John Hurst got onto us, and he had this to say about what he thinks is going on with the city accounts, and he was a little bit bothered about the large increase in reserves, about £150 million, and at the end of the day, we're dealing with apparently £29 million worth of cuts, which are going to lead to 1,000 job losses at the City Council. So let's have a listen to what John Hurst has to say and then get your comments on it, Craig.
Well, I've had a look at Bristol's accounts, and what I found is there's a discrepancy between the amount that's being kept in reserve, the amount that's being collected in council tax, and the cuts. The question is, how is the budget set? Well, once a year there's a general meeting of the council and the budget is set. The figure is more or less given to the voting members, and the voting members rarely actually look at the whole amount of money that the council has access to. And it would appear for the last 50 years, taxation, both national income tax and local, a large proportion of it has been siphoned off into offshore accounts. This came to notice to the general public a few years ago with the Iceland banking scandal, you may recall. You might wonder, well, why have local councils got money in Iceland? Well, it wasn't just Iceland, it's a number of places around the world. Back in 1972, there was an Act of Parliament that specified each local authority should have a senior financial person, and that's known as the Section 151 officer, because it was Section 151 of the 1972 Act. And those persons are sent on a course, and it's a course run by the Institute of Accountants. And only people that pass the course get to be Section 151 officers. Now, the problem is the syllabus that they study is a big secret. It's called a trade secret, but it's a big secret. So we can't really know what they're told to do. Now, these Section 151 officers, they're supposed to have a fiduciary responsibility, a financial responsibility, not just to the council, but to the taxpayers in each particular county. And if there is a problem with funds being taken abroad or funds not being allocated to the right use, it's these people that have got the final responsibility. And the problem is they're not talking.
Well, they may not be talking to John Hurst, who's a former Metropolitan Police PC and a campaigner for more openness amongst government accounting. But Craig, what do you make of that? The Section 151 officers, he says, aren't talking. He seems to be painting a picture of a kind of esoteric world.
He certainly did, and using the words like siphoned off and so on, I think probably investing abroad is not necessarily the same as siphoning off. I think I'd be interested to see what he's seen and to look through that in more detail, but I think it's a terminology issue there at the very least. But
what about the bigger point, which I think was more to do with, well, this is almost like a closed world within the council, and we're relying on you to sort of shine a light into there to make sure that everything is exactly as it should be.
So I don't think it's quite as closed a world as that's made out there. So SIPFA, the local government finance group, published guidelines that you can go online and look at yourself. There's no, you can read the, you can read them yourself online. So I don't think it's quite as sinister as that. They're also, certainly in my experience so far, you know, good public spirited people who aren't there to siphon money off to foreign accounts. I'm sure there have been some, but certainly the ones I've met so far.
I mean, just bring Martin Summers in here. Martin, you've been sitting there patiently. Because there was a problem, wasn't there, with the Icelandic banking collapse. Many people, including elected members here in Bristol, didn't know that money was over in Iceland.
Yeah, well, I can't claim any special expertise on this, although I think what you've got in the financial services industry is a desire for new ways of doing things to be adopted. So back in the 1980s, I think, Hammersmith and Fulham Council were persuaded, the officers were persuaded that it was a good idea for them to take out derivative contracts, basically, on which would protect them against changes in interest rates. And they didn't really understand what they were getting into, and the council ended up losing loads of money. So there was then questions about why they'd done it and so on. And, of course, local authorities, like many other people in Britain, were attracted to putting their money in the Ice Save and Landsbanki because they offered an attractive interest rate. So if you've got some money to park, financial advice may be from inside or from outside advisors, well, stick it in the Icelandic banks because you've got a better rate of interest.
Yeah, but the problem but is it's out of our legal jurisdiction. Something can happen to that money and gone forever.
And also, of course, there's a basic point that if you've got a higher interest rate on a bank account, that's probably because there's more risk involved, which is a basic financial point. I think, you see, if we do get a further financial crisis, as we might do, I mean, Deutsche Bank's been wobbling this week, we could have another rerun of 2008. If we do, you may then find that local authorities all over the world, not just in Bristol, will have, you know, some aspects of their funding will be tied up in these derivative
chains. This is the question, Martin. Will Deutsche Bank become the next Lehman Brothers?
Well, we don't know, do we? But, I mean, it's certainly possible.
Well, I'll tell you what we do know is that they have a €37 billion credibility gap. The Financial Times is saying.
Well, they've got a huge derivatives book, which on paper is several times bigger than German GDP. And this is the problem. I mean, these are the kind of things we should have been discussing since 2008. But of course, we've wasted an awful lot of time talking about Brexit, which is largely irrelevant to these major issues about the banking system.
And also, Market Watch is saying that actually this is down to Angela Merkel, that she's bungled this because she's denying any kind of discussions with Deutsche Bank about potential bailouts. That's making things worse.
Well, she's in a double bind because she's told all of the southern European countries, the pigs and so on, that they're not to bail their banks out. The Italians are getting fed up with being told this. Meanwhile, Renzi's pointed out, who's the Prime Minister of Italy, that you've got a massive problem with Deutsche Bank. And she's saying, no, but we won't bail them out. But Deutsche Bank need to be bailed out if they're not bailed out, then there's a potential for contagion into the whole international system.
You're nodding there, Craig. What do you make of it?
Well, no, I totally agree. She's backed herself into a terrible place there, really. I mean, obviously, I think there's a nervousness to be bailing out banks anyway, I think most people feel that way.
But the whole thing of we don't do that.
Exactly. And she's really stood on that for a long time. There's an election coming next year. Is she going to be able to go back on that now? I can't see that she can. And the whole Deutsche Bank thing's interesting.
Well, they had the same over quantitative easing. The Germans said for years, oh, we'll never do that. That's absolutely impossible. And now, of course, they've quietly gone, okay, let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the problem politically is that they've been taking a very hard line with other countries. Mm. And therefore they're not in a position not to take a hard line with themselves. But of course that's possibly idiotic, because if you allow the banking system to... The banking system may just collapse anyway, because it's over... You know, the derivatives market is absolutely out of control and has been for ages. So, I mean, this is all pretty abstract until it hits. And most of the time people don't... Even people with financial knowledge don't really understand it all. And therefore there's a tendency to ignore it until it really comes around and hits you over the head, you know.
Now, just to say what's happening with Deutsche Bank, it's always good, interesting to watch this on a Friday, isn't it? Because just as the markets are about to close, that's when the dodgy people do their stuff, so that they've got a couple of days, several days, in order to
There's a bank holiday Monday in Germany as well, so that's
even more likely, maybe, than to happen. Anyway, shares apparently have rebounded a bit this afternoon. But what do you think, Martin? Is this the next Lehman Brothers about to happen?
Well, it could be. I mean, and if it isn't Deutsche Bank, it'll be something else. And we should certainly be discussing this, because the possibility of a rerun of 2008 on a bigger scale has been there all along. Look, after the Brexit vote, everybody who voted for Brexit and others are saying, oh, well, there's not been much impact on the economy. Well, the one big impact on the economy is that we've switched the money press on again. We've had to go back to quantitative easing, which we'd stopped doing. And that's a symptom of the fact that, in actual fact, things aren't right. Well, quantitative easing, if you remember, was brought in by Gordon Brown as a temporary measure, which was going to run for a few weeks or months and then was going to stop. Here we are all these years later.
You almost seem
totally
to be saying this with glee, Martin.
It sounds like that, but I mean, the fact is the creation of the derivatives market should never have been allowed.
It's no point in crying over spilt milk.
I'm just pointing out that we've got used to having something. We've got used to having cancer. We've got used to having it, and therefore, yes, we've got cancer. And
I think it's more like heroin, isn't it, than cancer?
Well, we can use whatever metaphors we like. It's actually the derivatives market. But when the derivatives market was originally being set up, Brooksley Bourne, who was the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, said, look, we shouldn't allow these.
What we need to know is what do we do if and when this crash does happen, even if it's this weekend or something.
What will happen inevitably if there is a crash is that the governments, well, things that they've said that they wouldn't do under any circumstances,
if you were in Philip Hammond's shoes, what would you be suggesting?
Well, it's interesting to talk about Hammond, because of course George Osborne's policy is definitely dead. We're not going to have do you remember he was saying that we're going to have an act of parliament that we're going to reduce the deficit year on year.
His help to buy scheme for houses has just gone out the window.
Everything he stood for has gone out of the window. So in actual fact, Hammond is in a strong position, if he wanted to adopt McDonald's policy. And if he was a smart Tory Chancellor, that's what he'd do.
And what is that in a nutshell?
Well, basically he'd say, well, we're going to invest for the future by borrowing when interest rates are at 0%. We're not going to make the deficit the be-all and end-all of our policy.
We're going to hear from McDonald in a second from the Labour Party conference this week, but before we do that, Craig, chief executive of Deutsche Bank, John Cryan, is saying to his employees, don't panic.
Yeah, I mean, to come back to that point, I think since 2008 we should have spent a lot more time on banking reform, and all we've done is stick some plasters over it and carry on with exactly the same issues that we've had before. And as Martin's mentioned, there is a real risk of this happening again, and it happening very soon. Obviously, I'm hoping that it won't. But I think a long and hard look at derivatives markets and future selling and all the rest of it needs to be taken and thought through. It's very difficult, and there's a lot of power and money involved in it.
So, Martin, why is it that this hasn't been dealt with since 2008? The same conditions are there now.
Well, because Milton Friedman pointed this out a long time ago. When the government intervenes to bail an industry out, whether it's a coal industry, a car industry, or a banking industry, that's not a one-off, because you've then created a lobby which demands further resources. So what's happened, Philip Murovsky's written a very good book about this in the US, he's an academic, and what's happened is that the investment bankers who crashed everything got bailed out, and then they use the bailout money to lobby for further...
So this is a reward... This is a reward
leniency.
For failure, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and you could argue the free market textbook and the von Mises Institute and the real free marketers said you should have allowed the banking system to collapse. I wouldn't argue that. I think what should have been done is an orderly bankruptcy, but we haven't had that. They've been pumped back up again.
Is it going to collapse this weekend?
Well, I don't know if it's going to collapse this weekend, but I would argue that it's not an if question; it's a when question at this stage of the game.
So let's hear now from the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell. He was talking, I was really quite disappointed during the week, listening to Five Live, hearing him introduced on the BBC National Radio as John McDonald. He's not the guy that goes down to the American restaurant chain, no. He's John McDonnell, and he's Shadow Chancellor, and here he is speaking about his policy, where he really is saying now he's going to end austerity.
When we go into government united, be clear, be absolutely clear, we will end this government's austerity programme that's damaged so many lives and so many communities. But the first step, yes, is opposing austerity. The second is creating the alternative. So exactly as our economic advisor, Nobel Prize winner Joe Stiglitz said, we have to rewrite the rules of our economy. We will rewrite the rules to the benefit of working people on taxes, on investment and how our economic institutions work. So on tax, we know we can't run the best public services in the world on a flagging economy with a tax system that does not tax fairly or effectively. I want to congratulate a group of people as well, and Jonathan Reynolds in particular, because the Christians on the left that he is a representative of came up with their slogan, the hashtag Patriots Pay Their Taxes. It's a great slogan. Patriots do pay their taxes. Labour has already set the pace on tackling tax avoidance and tax evasion. We launched our tax transparency and enforcement programme to force the government into action. And again, I'd like to thank Rebecca Long Bailey for leading the Labour charge in Parliament to hold the tax dodgers to account.
Now, in that part of his speech, Martin Summers, John McDonnell seems to be saying effectively, look, we will start spending, we're going to end austerity, and we're going to start collecting money from companies and individuals who haven't been paying it. But the trouble is, of course, quite a lot of those companies are threatening to go abroad.
Yeah, well, obviously everybody's in theory in favour of people paying their taxes, but it's very difficult to get the money out of them. It doesn't help if you cut the staff of HMRC, Her Majesty's...
Well, just a minute, are Amazon and Starbucks, are they in favour of paying their taxes?
No, they're not, but I mean, the point is that it's going to be very... there are various ways you could change the tax system to make it more viable. One of the things is to tax things like land values rather than income and so on. These are big questions. You could also, I mean... What they've been doing as part of the austerity programme is cutting the number of tax collectors, which is absolutely bonkers. I mean, each individual civil service who works for HMRC more than pays for themselves in terms of their salary. So cutting them seems an absolutely ridiculous policy.
Well, that's one of the things that John McDonnell was saying that they are going to do, and Jeremy Corbyn, I think, in his speech as well, is to increase the number of people collecting tax.
Yeah, well, they cut the... They cut the tax collectors but increase the number of people checking up on benefit claimants, don't they? So that tells you all you need to know, doesn't it?
What do you make of what he was saying there about, is it going to be feasible to pay for this ending of austerity? Because, like I said to Martin, a lot of these companies, individuals will simply say to you, as Stephen Lansdowne's done, for example, I'm off abroad, see you later.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult in a globalised economy, and even, you know, we come out of the EU, it won't make things especially easier. Getting the money will be the difficult point. I think public shaming will work to an extent, and it has happened before. Companies have been shamed into paying their tax, but there needs to be a concerted global effort to cut down on it.
Yeah. John McDonnell's also, at the end of his speech, was talking about just a really basic idea, which is sharing wealth will make the whole country prosper, he believes.
I remember the day when we celebrated moving into our council house. My brother and I had a bedroom on our own for the first time, a garden front and rear. Both of us were born in NHS hospitals. Both of us had a great free education. There was an atmosphere of eternal optimism. Our generation always thought that from here on there would always be a steady improvement in people's living standards. We expected the lives of each generation would improve upon the last. But successive Tories governments put an end to that. Under Jeremy's leadership, I believe that we can restore that optimism, people's faith in the future. So I say this, in the birthplace of John Lennon, it falls to us to inspire people to imagine again. Imagine the society. Imagine. Imagine the society we can create. It's a society that's radically transformed, radically fairer, more equal, more democratic, yes, based upon a prosperous economy that's economically and environmentally sustainable, but where that prosperity is shared by all. That's our vision to rebuild and transform Britain. In this party, you no longer have to whisper its name. It's called socialism. Solidarity.
Well, it's that old-time religion, Tony. I think that was really just a bit of rhetoric. The actual, there wasn't a lot of detail of policy in there. Although, to be fair, McDonnell has elaborated quite a lot of policy, and he's got support. I mean, the kind of people he's been talking to are the stars in academic economics all over the world, and they're all looking at what we're doing in this country in the Labour movement with a great deal of interest. So I think that fundamentally, if you can't get the tax money in, although we haven't given up on that, the other way to go is that you borrow money and you actually increase the budget deficit. I know it sounds terrible to say such a thing, but if the economy's turning down, the deficit would increase.
Well, look, hang on, because anyway. John McDonnell's an advocate of people's QE. That is to say, where the money is being printed, that is as it is being now. But yeah, rather than going to keep asset prices and share prices up, it actually goes towards government spending projects, a bit like the Roosevelt New Deal in the 1930s.
Indeed, and you see, Hammond's got a similar, he's in a position, if he wished to do it, where he could have a Tory version of that in November, where he cuts taxes on workers, so
this is in the autumn statement.
Yeah, you could actually cut income tax on ordinary workers and stimulate the economy.
See,
the
interesting thing is, in the States at the time in 1933, there was this coup attempt, wasn't there? When Roosevelt was trying to get the New Deal going.
There was an attempt to remove Roosevelt by Prescott Bush, the grandfather of G.W. Bush, and various other top oligarchs tried to remove Roosevelt. They failed because Smedley Butler, who was the head of the was the former head of the U.S. Marine Corps, they penciled him in to be the front man for this sort of, you know, fascist style, Mussolini style dictatorship, and he went along with it until he'd found out who was involved, and then he went straight to Roosevelt and said, "What do you want me to do about this lot, sir?" And he said, "Well, bang them up, please, Smedley." So he did.
So, well, I mean, the sort of future, Craig, that John McDonnell's painting there is something. I mean, when you drive around Britain, you'll see quite a lot was being built in the 1930s here, where the government said, "Right, we're going to intervene after the 1929 crash, and we're going to get things moving again."
Yeah, so, you know, good old Keynesian economics, I think I'm definitely a believer in government spending. I think it's inevitable, the more money you spend, the more money circulates, and as always, once people with less money start spending, they start earning, they spend all their income as they have less of it. I think we'd all love to, John's message is brilliant, and I think probably all of us would love to live in a E&M Bank style utopian society. I'd be interested to see the detail, because at the moment that's great, but it is as Martin said, it is rhetoric at the moment. I'd be interested to see what steps we can take
to make
a difference in.
The Bank of England and the European Central Bank, and in fact the Federal Reserve in the States, are basically just printing money, and that money is going largely to prop up asset prices, that is to say stock in the stock markets and even the derivatives market. The money finds its way there. But the government is still saying, well, hang on, why aren't we having something? It seems as if the government has kind of lost control of the printing press for money, and someone else is printing the money. The government has kind of one step removed from it.
Yeah, I mean, the independence of the Bank of England does create that situation. There are pros and cons of that, aren't there? I think a Bank of England under direct control of the politicians
isn't it supposed to be nationalised, the Bank of England? I thought it was after the Second World War. Maybe you can help us out, Martin.
It was nationalised in 1946. And, of course, the Federal Reserve is actually a quango, which is actually run by its constituent parts, which are the bankers, the private banking system.
I mean, isn't the Bank of England a kind of quango, basically? It's one step removed, like the Federal Reserve.
The problem with the Bank of England is you get what's called regulatory capture. So although it's supposedly an independent public body, they tend to have people working there who are very friendly with top bankers in the private sector, and they tend to have the same sort of views. Although I think you'll find that there are some people inside the Bank of England structure who are actually quite radical and quite prepared to think in radical ways. I'm thinking of Andy Heyman in particular, because he's basically come out and said, well, the basic theory about loanable funds is wrong. In other words, banks lend money they've already got. He said, well, we all know they don't do that. They make it up out of nowhere. And, of course, that's gradually becoming accepted, even in the Bank of England.
So if they can make it up out of nowhere, then why don't you just give it to the government so they can get the economy going? Anyway, that seems to be sort of the basic message coming out from John McDonnell, and I would agree with it. Now, let's get on to the leader's speech, Jeremy Corbyn. He was talking about what he believes is quite a radical politicised Britain.
There is no doubt that my election as Labour leader a year ago and re-election this month grew out of a thirst for a new kind of politics and a conviction that the old way of running the economy in the country isn't delivering for more and more people. It's not, I promise you, about me, of course, or unique to Britain. But across Europe and North America and elsewhere, people are fed up with a so-called free market system that has produced grotesque inequality, stagnating living standards, and many calamitous foreign wars without end, and a political stitch-up which leaves the vast majority of people shut out of power. Since the crash of 2008, the demand for an alternative and an end to counterproductive austerity has led to the rise of new movements and parties in one country after another. But in Britain, it's happened in a different way, in the heart of traditional politics, in the Labour Party, which is something that we should be extremely proud of. It's exactly what Labour was founded for, to be the voice of the many, of social justice and progressive change from the bottom up. But it also means it's no good harking back to the tired old economic and political fixes of 20 and 30 years ago, because they won't work anymore. The old model is broken. We're in a new era that demands a politics and economics that meets the needs of our own time. Actually, even Theresa May gets it, sort of, that people want change. That's why she stood on the steps of Downing Street and talked about the inequalities and burning injustice in today's Britain. Well, she said it. In fact, she promised a country that works not for a privileged few, but for every one of us. But even if she manages to talk the talk, there are problems about walking the walk. This isn't a new government. It's David Cameron's government repackaged with progressive slogans, but with a new, harsh, right-wing edge, taking the country backwards and dithering before the historic challenges of Brexit.
Now, Craig Cheney, you're a Labour member for Hill Fields, also finance chap on the Marvin's cabinet. What do you make of what he's putting forward there as a sort of, I suppose, this whole idea of the grassroots of the party has become much bigger, because this is really where the radical, I mean, we're talking about Syriza and other of these fringe parties in other parts of Europe which have taken a long time to come through, that's now happening in the Labour Party itself. Do you agree with him?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, part of the problem, we haven't been able to meet for so long, I'm not even sure who our new members are at the moment. I think it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's a global phenomenon,
as you
said.
How do you mean you haven't been able to meet? What do you mean?
Oh, well, the Labour Party banned meetings for the past however many months, so we haven't actually met each other, so half the new members, I don't even know who they are.
So hopefully that's out of the way now, is it?
Yeah, that's done, yeah, so we can start meeting again. I think we're meeting again in a few weeks. So it'll be good to see. It'll be interesting to see what walks of life people are coming from and into the party. I'd be worried if it were, just university educated liberals or all the nicknames that people give them. We want to see a real grassroots movement, real working class people. I look at the council at the moment. I look around. We've got Marvin from Easton. We've got Paul Smith from Hartcliffe. We've got me from Kingswood. We've got real working class people doing things for the people that we represent and the areas that we live in. I'd like to see that across the country.
Martin Summers?
Well, obviously, I tend to, I'm a supporter of Corbyn, so I generally agree with what he says. But I think where he's weak, in my view, is we've got to change the political system. The first past the post political system has allowed this kind of destructive row in the Labour Party because we're forced to have that row, because we're forced to actually, you know, beat each other.
Well, there was a lot of discussion about this at the Labour conference, apparently, about changing the electoral system, a big queue of people going to a fringe meeting all about it, yeah. And also another one about the basic income being discussed by the Labour Party for the first time.
Well, in actual fact, MacDonald's views on this are closer to mine than Jeremy Corbyn. When Jeremy Corbyn came to Bristol last year, at the meeting that he had, I asked the first question. I said, well, what about PR? Because in New Zealand, the Labour Party forced proportional representation because it was a way of making sure that radical change could be effected without being blocked. And they had a Labour government at the time, and it wasn't satisfactory to the grassroots. So they changed the electoral system and basically reformed their own government. Now, we're not in government in this country, but we've not really a two-party system anymore. We haven't been for a long time, certainly not in Scotland, Northern Ireland or Wales. So I think we're ultimately going to have to change the political system. But the other point I'd make is about Theresa May, is that if the Tories were flexible, they could move to the left here and actually clean up. Because they could say, right, well, all that free market stuff, that's history. We're going to go back to our traditional centrist policy.
Well, they don't have to bother, do they? They don't have to bother. Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, yes, UKIP.
Well, UKIP's economics are often on that side of the that side of the fence. Mm. So I think there's a general change in atmosphere going on, because everybody realises that just having a free market, especially a free market where the banks are bailed out by the government, that's not viable, is it?
So, Craig, did you vote for Owen Smith or Jeremy Corbyn?
I voted for Owen Smith, yeah.
Don't you think that maybe this is been a bit of a waste of time, this whole leadership election? Just what it's happened at the end of the day is Jeremy Corbyn's now got an increased mandate.
Yeah, I mean, and it just led us to infighting and unnecessary sort of, I guess, entrenchment for a while. But I think it's important that we have this fundamental debate in the heart of the Labour Party. What are we for? Who do we stand for? Personally, I usually take a pragmatic view on these things. I'd rather go into the next election fighting on Labour's policies and not on Jeremy's fair or unfair history, which, let's face it, is going to be the front page of every newspaper for the entire election campaign. But totally unfairly, I'm sure, but that is what will happen.
Well, the newspapers are owned by people, aren't they? And those people tend to be quite wealthy.
I'm not sticking up for them by any sense of the imagination, by any stretch of the imagination, but I think you can be clever with how you work in that.
Do you still go with this idea that Jeremy's not electable?
I worry personally. So this is just my own personal belief. I have a fear that we will spend the election campaign fighting pictures of Jeremy with people that certainly people in places like Hillfields will not understand, and it will be the arguments will be very complicated and not covered fairly in any anything.
Well, that happened in London, didn't it, with Sadiq Khan? He was linked to the 7/7 bombers, sorts of things, but London just said no.
Yeah, in one newspaper on a couple of occasions.
Well, and on the BBC, night after night, actually, as well, nationally. Yeah. So there was a lot of attempts to get Sadiq Khan, say, well, look, this guy, he's linked with this guy, everybody's shared a platform with someone else who's a terrible person, and London almost turned its back on what the media was saying and said, no, we're not interested in any of that.
Yeah, well, that would be wonderful. I mean, it's interesting, the polling that says 51% of people think media coverage of Jeremy Corbyn is biased, so it does show that there's a level of understanding.
There must be something to it, yeah. Mm. Anyway, so let's have a listen to a final clip from Jeremy Corbyn's speech at the Labour conference. Of course, we've got the Tories this weekend and next week. And this is where he's really talking about gerrymandering, a more serious matter where it looks as if there are attempts to fix the next election.
Who seriously believes that the Tories could ever stand up to the privileged few? They are the party of the privileged few. Funded by the privileged few, for the benefit of the privileged few. Theirs is a party, after all, that now wants to force through an undemocratic boundary review based on an out-of-date version of the electoral register with nearly 2 million voters missing. They've dressed it up as a bid to cut the cost of politics by abolishing 50 constituencies, but the 12 million savings are dwarfed by the expense of the 260 peers David Cameron appointed at a cost of £34 million a year. It's nothing more than a cynical attempt to gerrymander the next election. And this is from a Prime Minister who was elevated to a job without a single vote being cast after a pantomime farce which saw one leading Tory after another falling on their swords. When I meet Theresa May across the dispatch box, I know that only one of us has been elected to the office they hold by the votes of 250,000 people. In any case, the Tories are simply incapable of responding to the breakdown of the old economic model, because that failed model is absolutely in their political DNA. It's what they deliver every time they're in government. Tory governments deregulate, they outsource, privatise, and they stand by as inequality grows. They've cut taxes for the privileged few, sold off our national assets to them, always on the cheap, and turned a blind eye to their chronic tax avoidance. They're so committed to the interests of the very richest, they've recruited Sir Philip Green into government as something called an efficiency czar. I'm not quite sure what an efficiency czar does, but I would simply say this. Well, government might be a bit more efficient if the super rich like Sir Philip actually paid their taxes.
Now, Martin, Jeremy Corbyn there is talking about the privatisation and deregulation from the Conservatives, but of course that is exactly what New Labour was doing.
Well, I think there was a continuation. There was an understanding that the basic lineaments of the Thatcherite settlement were going to continue, and they did, and everything carried on until the crisis of 2008. And if you remember, at the time when RBS was nationalised, Gordon Brown was keen to stress that it wasn't being nationalised, it was just being given public money to help it through, and he didn't want to use the horrible N-word nationalisation. And that just shows how far to the right the centre of gravity of the Labour Party had shifted during that era. But of course now the pendulum swings, and it is swinging, and I think even the Tories are now being pulled by that pendulum swing in the opposite direction.
Craig, Jeremy's used his speech there to basically accuse the Conservative Party of fixing the next general election.
Yeah, I think it's quite shameful, actually. I think to have 2 million voters not counted in the final, or those that registered to vote in the European election, I think it's shocking. It really needs a rethink. Also, as Jeremy mentions, we're stuck in the House of Lords, so it can't be, if it's cost-saving as they claim, well, it clearly isn't that, is it?
Martin, you said something last week, I think, about the idea of doing boundaries on the number of people rather than registered voters.
Why should the boundaries? I mean, leaving aside the unfairness of the electoral system, I think we do need PR. It's just the norm. We had a PR for a mayoral election in Bristol, got PR in Wales, PR in Northern Ireland, otherwise there'd be a war, PR in Scotland, PR in Denmark, PR in France, because they have two rounds. So, you know, we're going to have to go there in the end. But, of course, if you're going to have a redrawing of boundaries, it should be on the basis of population, not on the basis of the people on the electoral register. Some people aren't registered. For example, asylum seekers are not registered, even though they create loads of work for local MPs.
Let me also remind you, we've got 29 Conservative MPs being investigated for fraud in the last election. Still nothing heard about that, even though an SNP woman was charged this week about it. None of the Tories have been anyway.